Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is Exploration. Every week on Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science, as well as issues concerning war, peace, and the environment. And today, leading off, we're going to summarize some of the top stories in science and society. Leading off, new controversy about precisely how much oil there is in the Gulf, and how much has evaporated, how much has been eaten by bacteria, and how much has already washed ashore. So far, three groups of scientists have challenged the government's report, stating that the government is simply too optimistic. So far, not one, not two, but three groups of scientists have criticized the government report, stating that the government is simply too optimistic in assessing how much oil is still left in the Gulf of Mexico. And also, just a few weeks ago, the Northern Lights, Aurora Borealis, lit up not just Canada, but Michigan and Wisconsin, sitting off scores of telephone calls from anxious homeowners who've never seen the Northern Lights before. Well, some people think that maybe the sun is headed for a monster temper tantrum. After all, the next sunspot cycle peaks in 2012, and some people say, aha, maybe that's a sign of doomsday. Maybe it's the end of the world. Well, I don't think so, but it's good to analyze the science behind solar flares, the aurora, and what does happen if the sun does go berserk. And then I'd like to bring on our special guest today. We're very delighted to have with us Michael Moore, not the filmmaker, but a weapons analyst, talking about his book, Twilight War. Did you know there's a secret war going on? A war being waged in outer space with satellites and secret experiments and hush-hush projects. Well, these are the things we're going to be talking about with Michael Moore, author of the book, Twilight War. But before we begin, let me say that on September 1st at 9 p.m. on the Science Channel, I'll be hosting the second season of my series called Sci-Fi Science, based on my New York Times bestseller, Physics of the Impossible. Everything you wanted to know about teleportation, time travel, force fields, phasers, lightsabers, warp drive, starships, everything you've seen on the silver screen explained in Sci-Fi Science, Physics of the Impossible. Watch for it on the Science Channel starting September 1st, every week on Wednesday. Well, let's jump right into some of the top stories of the past week. Well, just as the United States is crowing about the fact that the oil leak in the Gulf of Mexico has been shut for the past month, the government releases a report, a rather rosy report, saying that, well, hey, most of the oil is gone in the Gulf of Mexico, so why are people complaining so much? In fact, the government report states that perhaps 74% of the oil that leaked out is pretty much gone. Therefore, the worst is over. Well, as soon as that very rosy government report came on, critics began to say, not so fast, not so fast. Many of the numbers are simply made up again, and they're simply too optimistic. Well, first of all, some of the same governmental groups that were involved in lowballing the estimate of how much oil was coming out of the leak months ago are the same as those involved with this recent government study. You recall that BP said that perhaps only 1,000 barrels of oil were leaking out into the Gulf per day. 1,000 barrels per day. As a consequence, everyone thought that, well, hey, we can manage with that. We can cap it, no big problem. And then as the days and weeks went by, that number kept crawling up from 1,000 to 5,000 and eventually 40 to 60,000 barrels of oil a day leaking into the Gulf. Well, surprise, surprise, some of the same governmental officials that were involved in that estimate, which was woefully wrong by a factor of 60, are now involved in this controversy where they say that 74% of the oil that leaked out is pretty much gone. Well, let's break down some of their logic. First, they say that, of course, the well has been capped, therefore that limits the amount of oil that was leaked into the Gulf. Next, they say, look at bacteria, which does, in fact, take up some of the oil. Believe it or not, naturally occurring bacteria will, in fact, eat oil. Next, they say, look at evaporation. Oil by itself rising to the surface does evaporate, and as a consequence, a lot of that oil that we see in the television news, a lot of it is simply gone. And then they say that some of the oil has already washed up on shore and are no longer a threat to the marine life there. But of course, the oil that has already leaked out to the environment has to be cleaned up. But they say the worst is over. Well, now several universities have looked over these numbers and say, wait a minute, you're once again lowballing all these numbers. First of all, we don't know precisely how much oil was leaked into the Gulf at all, because, of course, BP was not monitoring that very carefully. Next, they say the government is way too optimistic in terms of estimating how much bacteria has churned up and eaten the oil, and also is way too optimistic in terms of assuming that the evaporation has then eliminated a lot of the oil. Well, just this week, yet another report, a third report, came out criticizing the government once again, this time saying the government doesn't know basically what it's talking about because a lot of the oil is still underwater. In order to get evaporation to take place, oil has to rise to the surface. At the surface, yes, indeed, you do get evaporation of oil. But the government estimated that a lot of the oil was already on the surface and hence had evaporated. Yet another report saying, wait a minute, they're looking at the actual plumes, not simply eyeballing these numbers or making these numbers up, but actually doing measurements, concrete measurements, reality, rather than the fiction of making up numbers. And they say that underwater plumes still exist, a lot of them, indicating that you cannot get evaporation because the plumes haven't even hit the surface of the water. Well, this controversy, of course, will go on for weeks, months, maybe even years. The well itself has been capped, and perhaps in a few more weeks, we'll finally have the relief well drilled, which will kill the well officially, perhaps, maybe, we don't know for sure, after Labor Day. However, as far as the agony of the oil spill itself in the Gulf is concerned, that's going to go on for weeks, months, and years, even as scientists debate how much of the oil is still there. And the short answer is, we don't know. Also, just a few weeks ago, a lot of homeowners in Michigan and Wisconsin were startled to look up into the sky and see lights, the northern lights, the aurora borealis, dancing right over their heads. Well, it's not supposed to happen like that. Usually the people of Scandinavia, northern Canada, Alaska, they see the northern lights. We're not used to seeing the northern lights in the continental U.S. And some people then began to say, aha, maybe this means the beginning of a doomsday. Some doomsayers are saying that, look, in the year 2012, that's when we're going to be hitting the next peak of the sunspot cycle, and therefore that could be a signal of the end of the world. Well, maybe, maybe not, but let's take a look at the science behind solar flares. Every 11 years, the north and south pole of the sun flip, unlike the magnetic fields of the earth. And when the magnetic fields of the sun flip, it releases a burst of energy. That energy eventually hits the earth. It rains down the northern and southern magnetic lines, creating the aurora borealis when the radiation hits the atmosphere. Well, that's all well and good, but once in a century, once every two centuries, the sun goes berserk for reasons we don't understand. The last one was in 1859. It's called the Carrington Event, named after the astronomer who first recorded this. It turns out that the Carrington Event was humongous, huge. First of all, the northern lights were not seen just in Michigan and Wisconsin. They were seen in Cuba, and you could actually read the newspaper at night by the light of the aurora borealis. Well, back then, the electric age didn't really exist. We didn't have radar. We didn't have telecommunications. We didn't have the internet. We didn't have GPS. We didn't have transformers and power stations. We didn't have any of the luxuries of the modern world. However, we did have telegraph wires. It turns out that many telegraph wires were burnt out. Also, some telegraph wires kept on transmitting signals with no power at all, just by the power of the solar flare energizing the telegraph wires. That was enough to send signals all by itself. Well, nobody expects another Carrington event anytime soon. However, you can't rule it out. It's like earthquake prediction. It's basically witchcraft. Now, if that Carrington event were to happen today, it really would be catastrophic. We're talking not just one Katrina, but perhaps hundreds of Katrinas simultaneously taking place around the planet Earth. And let's break it down. A Carrington event, sufficient to light up the sky of Cuba, sufficient to damage telegraph wires, would first knock out our satellites, carrying weather reports, the internet, they would be wiped out. Astronauts would also be threatened because of the solar activity. And on the planet Earth, we're talking about transformers being knocked out. In fact, in the year 2003, 14 transformers were knocked out in South Africa because of another monster solar flare emanating from the sun. However, thank God, that solar flare missed the Earth. In fact, I still remember in the year 2003, scientists were tracking sunspot activity very carefully because these sunspots sort of act like rifles, that shoot blistering amounts of radiation into outer space. Luckily, this rifle missed the Earth. It was pointed away from the planet Earth, and so we were not hit with a monster amount of radiation comparable perhaps to the Carrington event of 1859. If the Earth were in a slightly different position in the year 2003, we might have been hit once again with a huge solar storm sufficient to wipe out communications and telecommunications and power on the Earth. Now, look at it this way. When we have a power blackout, what happens? Well, first, there is the inconvenience of not having our air conditioners and our television. However, after a few days, it starts to get serious. I mean, after all, we're talking about wiping out of credit card transactions, commerce comes to a halt, and also your refrigerator is out. How many days does it take for the food in your refrigerator to rot? Well, 3 to 4 days. After that, you expect the emergency crews from outside to come in to fix the power lines, right? Well, what happens if they don't come? Because they're also hit. In fact, what happens if 100 major cities on the planet Earth are hit simultaneously? Then we're talking about not just a minor inconvenience. We're talking about food riots. We're talking about people going to the supermarket, tearing down the bars and raiding the supermarket for canned goods because their food is all rotten. And again, communications are out. You can't fly away because the airports are out. In fact, airplanes flying in the skies would be in serious trouble because they won't be able to land their airplanes because all communications with the air controllers is also out. So we're talking not just about a small inconvenience. We're talking about a Katrina multiplied by a factor of 100, 200 on the planet Earth. Now, to be fair, these events do not happen often. In fact, we don't know how often they happen. The last one was 1859. Another one in the year 2003 missed the planet Earth. Maybe there are 1-in-100-year event. We don't know for sure. But cities that ignore earthquake warnings are sometimes leveled. For example, Haiti had no institutional memory of an earthquake which devastated that country centuries ago, and we may be another Haiti because we also have no institutional memories of the Carrington event of 1859. So we don't want to be Chicken Littles. However, we have to realize the fact that we should reinforce our power stations. We should shield our satellites. We should do something. It wouldn't take much to reinforce and shield our power stations and our telecommunications, because it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when we have another Carrington event when the sun goes berserk. Thank you. Tom, I'd like to bring on our special guest today. We're very delighted to have with us Michael Moore, not the filmmaker, but the weapons analyst, author of the book Twilight War, The Folly of U.S. Space Dominance. You know, the United States hit the moon just the other day. We bombed the moon. Does it have military value? Well, not really. However, there's a larger question, and that is in the future. In the future, nations will see space as a military asset. We saw that during the Gulf War crises. And then the question is, what steps, what secret steps are nations making right now, even as we speak, to prepare for a possible war in outer space? A war that could wipe out satellites. It could cause a tremendous collapse of the industrial infrastructure as power lines go out, communications go blank, the internet is stopped. It could cause all sorts of havoc if we have a war in outer space. So with us once again is Michael Moore. The book is called Twilight War, The Folly of U.S. Space Dominance. The first question for you is, how did you first get interested in peace and disarmament issues?
I've been interested in peace and disarmament issues all my adult life, and certainly after we had children, it became a more personal thing to me. I've always thought nuclear weapons were clearly immoral, and that goes back to the 1950s.
And tell us about your involvement with the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists.
Well, I became editor in 1991 and retired in 2000, and that was the end of the Cold War. Our circulation was slipping, and I told the board at my first board meeting we should be overjoyed that our circulation was slipping because that meant the nuclear threat was waning. But I got involved because I wanted to do whatever I could to ensure that nuclear weapons were never again used.
Okay. Now, most Americans don't know that there is a very fierce competition to dominate outer space. They heard about the Chinese test that took place several months ago, and many analysts were outraged that thousands of pieces of debris are now in orbit around the Earth as a consequence of the Chinese test. So first of all, tell us a little bit about the Chinese test.
Well, it was a test in January of last year, and they smashed an alien weather satellite, a Chinese weather satellite, with a so-called kinetic kill weapon, which means they just ran into it, smashed it into many, many thousands of pieces. It replicated a test in a rough kind of way that we conducted in 1985. The Chinese test is interesting because the Chinese have wanted us to, us meaning the United States and the rest of the world, to negotiate a new outer space treaty that would prevent any kind of conflict in space and weapons in space and space-related weapons on the ground and so on. And we have dismissed that. Every time the Chinese have brought it up, we have dismissed the idea. And I regard it as a shot across the bow. The Chinese were saying, if you intend to dominate space, we're going to challenge you. But we would rather, the Chinese would rather, negotiate a treaty.
Okay. Now let's say a few things about the past, because most people were caught flat-footed when the Chinese test took place, not realizing that there's a long history of this going all the way back to the beginning of the space age. So isn't it true that even with the launching of Sputnik back in 57, there were voices talking about a potential war in outer space?
Oh, absolutely. And President Eisenhower anticipated this kind of thing as early as 1955 and established a space for peaceful purposes policy for the United States because he did not want to see the Cold War extended into space. He thought that would be very dangerous. Then after Sputnik, a lot of people criticized Eisenhower for being flat-footed on this issue. Actually, he wasn't. But he was finally criticized. Even his own chief of staff of the Air Force, Thomas Dresser White, argued publicly in February of 1958 that control of space should be the goal of all Americans. But Eisenhower resisted that idea. He did not want to be the first president to militarize space. He did not want to see the Cold War go into space. And that policy was followed by Kennedy and Johnson and eventually became the Outer Space Treaty of 1967, an international treaty that is still in force.
But isn't it true that even during that period of time, the United States was in fact building killer satellite systems and in fact had an operational system based in the Pacific with Thor missiles that actually detonated hydrogen bombs in outer space?
It's true that the United States research systems and the Soviet Union was very aggressive when it came to space. The Soviet Union, until the Outer Space Treaty, was testing various systems. The Soviet Union was even talking about putting hydrogen bombs in space or in suborbital space. There were two different systems they were talking about. And the United States was reactive in that respect. We did have a Thor system with a hydrogen bomb warhead that was to be used as an anti-satellite system. But it was a very limited system. We could launch two Thors, which wouldn't have made any real difference. And then the system was activated, but in a very clumsy kind of way. It was clear to everybody that we didn't want to use it. Nobody really wanted to use it. Then later on, we did test nuclear weapons in space, and then one, the so-called Starfish Prime test, knocked out the electrical service in parts of Hawaii, and it killed a few satellites of other nations, and we realized that exploding nuclear weapons in space was not a good idea.
And isn't it true that Robert McNamara began to be a little bit skeptical about shooting hydrogen bombs in outer space because it would create an electromagnetic pulse? In fact, wasn't this the first time we've ever seen an electromagnetic pulse in action that could wipe out our own communication systems?
You're absolutely right. The electromagnetic pulse was perceived as very dangerous to our systems and to other kinds of systems, military and civilian.
And didn't Robert McNamara actually go ahead and try to deploy a anti-ballistic missile system called the Sprint, which never became fully operational and wasted billions of dollars?
He did. He was very skeptical of it. He was pushed into it by hardliners on the right, and it was viewed as a Chinese, anti-Chinese system. It was pretty well understood by them that we could not defeat a Soviet attack, but we believed that the Chinese would someday have missiles, and then the system would at least defeat a small Chinese attack. But it was only operational for a few months, and billions of dollars were spent. It was not popular with anybody except the aerospace industry and certain senators and congressmen.
Okay, so we went through the 60s and 70s, and then in the 80s, President Ronald Reagan changes the whole landscape by talking about Star Wars, and people were talking about Buck Rogers-type laser particle beam accelerators in outer space, zapping things from outer space. What happened to the original Buck Rogers schemes?
Well, the Ronald Reagan's Star Wars scheme was kind of fantastical. He was sold on it by Edward Teller and some other people, and it was viewed as an anti-ballistic missile system, and we would have anti-ballistic missile systems in space. We would have battle stars in space and so on and so forth. It was a kind of a crazy thing. I have to say Ronald Reagan was far-reaching in one way. He believed that the mad system of mutual destruction was literally mad. He wanted to get rid of nuclear weapons, and he believed that the Star Wars system would do that. Meanwhile, there were people on his staff and in his administration. He viewed it as a way of advancing space control. If we had anti-ballistic missile systems, we could also have anti-satellite systems, and we could control space. But it just wasn't technically possible then. It may be technically possible now to hit satellites from space. It still isn't possible to hit ballistic missiles, in my opinion.
Now, if you do, in fact, have a Star Wars shield, isn't that also a potential first strike weapon? President Richard Nixon used this analogy. Nixon said if you have two gladiators, the first gladiator strikes first, disarming most of the enemy's ability, and then you have a shield to absorb a weakened second strike from the second gladiator. So in some sense, this system is not only a defensive system, it's also an offensive first strike system, right?
You're right about that. Almost any defensive system of that kind can be viewed as part of a first strike system. And that's very dangerous, it's unstable, and that's why a lot of military people actually oppose these kinds of systems because of the dangers of being viewed as a first strike system. They people who push it most ardently tend to be civilians, people who have never been in war, don't understand war, and who have hardline ideologies.
Okay, so in the 80s came the big disappointment that Ronald Reagan's great schemes violated the known laws of physics and the known laws of technology. However, in the 90s, isn't it true that the United States kept on going with a limited off-the-shelf Star Wars system, shooting a bullet with another bullet over the Pacific?
It's true that in the 90s we continued these systems, but mainly after the fall of the Soviet Union, a new paradigm emerged, which had the support of a lot of military people as well as hardline civilian people. It went like this. The Cold War had been very dangerous to both the United States and the Soviet Union. We should not permit another existential threat to the United States. Therefore, the way to do that was to be overwhelmingly militarily dominant on land, at sea, in the air, and in space. And I'm very concerned about the space end of that, because the idea that space should be reserved for peaceful purposes is part of international law. But during the 90s, great progress was made in developing the doctrine for space control and even the hardware to exercise space control.
Okay, now take us to the present. Take us to the present in the sense of what are the capabilities of the United States, Russia, and China vis-a-vis space weapons? What's the state of the art today?
Well, the state of the art is this. The United States is many, 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 many years ahead of China and the United and Russia in terms of being able to control space with anti-satellite weapons. We are working on several techniques. The most important, really, is small robotic satellites that can be launched into space and seek and find and rendezvous with any satellite we want them to. And, of course, if you can rendezvous with another satellite, then you can do damaging things to it. We call these robotic satellites peaceful in that they could service future American satellites. But you can call that peaceful if you want. But if you can come up to another satellite and service it, you can also destroy it or damage it.
Well, that concludes the first part of our interview with Michael Moore, author of the book Twilight War, The Folly of U.S. Space Dominance. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230 for a copy of today's program. And if you get the Science Channel, watch for a 12-episode series that I'll be hosting based on my best-selling book, Physics of the Impossible. 12 episodes that I'll be hosting for the Science Channel. Welcome. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is the second half of Exploration. In the first half of Exploration, we began a discussion with Michael Moore, a weapons analyst, author of a rather disturbing book called Twilight War, The Folly of U.S. Space Dominance. Well, maybe you're one of the people that woke up early in the morning to watch us bomb the moon. Well, people ask the question, was there a military application to such technology? Well, the answer is yes, but rather minimal. It doesn't really take that much to bomb the moon. We can reach the moon in 3 days, which is probably too long if you're going to be fighting a nuclear war on the planet Earth. However, there really is a twilight war going on, not with regards to bombing the moon, but secret classified studies being done on space warfare, satellite warfare, killer satellite warfare, ASAT warfare. And with us today to discuss this is Michael Moore, the weapons analyst. The book is called Twilight War, The Folly of U.S. Space Dominance. And when we last left off, we were talking about space weapons, and even lasers can be used in outer space to destroy or blind enemy satellites.
We're very far along in these programs. We're also working on a ground-based laser system that could damage or possibly even destroy satellites of other nations in space.
And in fact, wasn't there a Star Wars test, maybe 10 years ago, where the space shuttle was supposed to intercept a laser beam from the planet Earth? However, they misread inches and meters. And as a consequence of that, the media picked up on it. Because we misread meters and inches, the space shuttle oriented itself toward outer space rather than toward the Earth. And as a consequence, the Star Wars test failed. But isn't it true, therefore, that we are using the space shuttle to test space weapons in the sense that we shoot lasers, very low-power lasers, at the space shuttle?
Well, I wouldn't call those weapons tests. We are researching lasers, and in fact, we illuminated a satellite in 1997 with a low-power laser. But we are working on the technology. But the main thing we're working on are these robotic small satellites, because they have the potential for doing almost anything we want to in space. They have the potential for hitting targets in low Earth orbit, which are just a few hundred miles above the Earth, or in higher orbits, many thousands of miles above the Earth. That's where the big threat is right now, and other countries understand this. They're very very keen on developing a treaty that would stop the development of such weapons.
Now, isn't it true that smaller nations like India, being outgunned and being overwhelmed by U.S. technology, have issued some dark threats that they may launch what is called a keg of nails? A keg of nails would be a barrel of nails with gunpowder inside, very low tech. You simply detonate it in outer space, and since most satellites are European and U.S. satellites, these nails then basically wipe out a good chunk of U.S. systems.
Well,
so this
that's one of the ultimate nightmares in the space business. It's very easy to destroy a satellite, any kind of satellite of any size, by putting debris, pellets, gravel, nails, whatever, in the orbital path. And then that idea has been around for at least 40 years, and it's a terrible thing if you do that. And if you do several of those, you could drain space almost forever.
Now, the question is, who would suffer the most if there is a showdown in outer space? The Chinese have an expression, never pick up a rock, only to drop it on your own feet. Now that the United States is reaching for superiority in outer space, the question is, will it drop it on its own feet? So who would suffer the most if war breaks out in space?
Well, you're getting to the heart of an important issue, a dispute between a lot of high-level military people, mainly in the Air Force, and civilian hardliners. The high-level military people in the Air Force tend to argue we have the most to lose, meaning the United States. About 850 active satellites are in orbit, and about half of those, a little bit more than half, are American. So if we ever had a conflict in space, we would stand the risk of losing many, many, many of our own satellites. So the argument, and I've heard this from colonels and generals, the argument is, why are we being so belligerent in our space policy? Why are we using rhetoric and developing hardware that might start another arms race? Because if the arms race ever turns into a conflict, we do have a lot to lose.
Now, if you have two gunfighters about to shoot it out at OK Corral, and one gunfighter grabs sand and throws sand in the enemy's eyes, blinding the enemy, that's like space war, in which case the blinded gunfighter then shoots randomly in all directions. So if it does come to space war, not only do we have all the space debris in outer space, but won't the blinded enemies basically fire randomly and create even more havoc?
Well, that's another important argument. War games have borne this out, that if we play a war game, and if we, as you put it, blind the other side by damaging their satellites, there's going to be retaliation. It's going to be much more random than it would have been otherwise. It's a very dangerous business to take out the other nation's satellites. I have to emphasize that a lot of military people are really against this aggressive space policy we're talking about. There's a real split here between hardliners, neoconservatives, triumphalists on the one side, and fairly sober military people on the other side.
Now, Vladimir Putin has basically gone ballistic over the Star Wars anti-missile system being based in Eastern Europe, even though the United States has tried to reassure it that it's basically to be used against Iran and, quote, rogue nations. The Russians are fuming that it's basically in their sphere of influence. So tell us what's happening now in Europe.
Well, you know, we are talking about having two facilities in Europe, and the Russians are very unhappy about that, because it would be a little bit like the Russians putting a couple systems into Canada. I mean, it's right on their doorstep, as Canada is on ours. And if you put facilities on their doorstep, who's to say that 10 years from now that we won't use them in other ways as coercive tools against Moscow? It's a very ambiguous situation. Countries or national leaders look at the intentions of other countries, but they mainly look at capabilities. Intentions can change, but capabilities do not change so easily. And if one country has a lot of power in one area, they may say, we will not use it now, but 10 years from now, the intentions may change, and the Russians are very conscious of that.
And Putin even raised the stakes last year when he put his weapons basically on alert status and threatened Europe with nuclear retaliation. So this is really upping the stakes, right? And while in the United States there's almost no publicity around this, the Russians are fuming.
Well, they're fuming, but this alert business is rhetorical. Both countries, both the United States and Russia, have weapons on alert, and they say they're detargeted, but it's just a matter of, it would take a matter of minutes to retarget them. It's done for rhetorical effect. It's not a strategic change, in my opinion.
Now let's talk about China. If you read the Chinese concerns, first of all, they believe that a Star Wars system would decouple Taiwan away from mainland China. And China has said, more or less, that there's only one scenario in which they would unleash the power of their military, and that is over Taiwan. So isn't the United States touching very sensitive areas when there is a possible decoupling of Taiwan from China, in which case China has already stated that it will go to war?
Well, the Chinese-Taiwan situation, I think, has been handled very clumsily in this country. You're quite right. The Chinese will not tolerate a true independence move by Taiwan. On the other hand, the Taiwanese tend to act very independently in many areas, and we have sold them weapons for years and years and years. It's always a tense situation. And the space assets used for military purposes have accentuated this. One of the favorite war games being played in the military over here is, what if the Chinese launch a surprise attack against satellites, which are, in effect, surveilling China and Taiwan? What if they blind us? What do we do then? And this is kind of a silly scenario. The Chinese have no interest in taking on the United States militarily. They make goods for the United States. They make goods for the Western world, and they need those jobs. Meanwhile, we need the Chinese. The Chinese are buying roughly $200 billion worth of treasury notes and bonds every year. That keeps our interest rates low. We're in bed together financially, economically, so why would there be a military challenge from China? Why can't we cooperate? We're in a new century. I think the old Cold War paradigms don't work anymore.
Now, it's been noted that even a limited Star Wars shield might might conceivably be affected not against 1,000 missiles, but against 20 missiles. And it's also been pointed out that the Chinese have approximately 20 missiles that might be able to reach California. Now, given the mathematics of the fact that even a limited Star Wars system might be affected against a full-scale Chinese attack on California, isn't that concern on the part of the Chinese?
It's been a concern since the 70s. Our limited, so-called limited missile defense system proposed in the 70s was advertised by McNamara as an anti-Chinese system. And war games today still look at the Chinese threat, I put threat in quotation marks, and in the anti-ballistic missile system, which we advertise as being aimed at North Korea and Iran, is viewed by very many military people and hardliners as an anti-Chinese system, as a way of hedging our bets against the so-called Chinese threat. The Chinese understand this perfectly well. Everybody in the military space business understands that it well, too. Our anti-ballistic missile system is not aimed at North Korea or Iran. It's aimed at China.
And let's say a few things about Iran. It was just announced yesterday that Israel, senior officials in Israel, have just announced that it appears as if an attack on Iran is inevitable. So some people say, in defense of a Star Wars-type shield and Star Wars-type funding, they say that warfare in the future will be waged from outer space, like the Persian Gulf War. Most of that was actually waged from the air rather than from the ground. So what do you say to those people who say that in order to defend Israel or in other regional conflicts, we have to dominate space?
What I say to those people that it's fantastical that aggressive moves in space are more likely to start a war than to prevent a war, more likely to start an arms race than to prevent an arms race. I believe in this century the way forward is simply to sit down and talk and see if we can negotiate a treaty that would prevent any nation from dominating space or having the capability to control space. In fact, since 1981, delegates to the UN have voted every year since 1981 to ask the Conference on Disarmament to sit down and draft a space treaty, a new space treaty, that would prevent an arms race in space. Every year they vote for that, and every year the United States blocks any such discussions at the Conference on Disarmament in Geneva. If we're a nation based on the rule of law, and I think we are, certainly one of our major founding values, I think we have to say we're acting in a lawless manner there. If every country in the world says they want a new treaty, we should not block it. We should at least sit down and talk. It might not be possible to negotiate a new treaty. It might be more difficult than other countries think. But we're not going to know until we sit down and talk seriously.
Okay, well, we'll talk about a positive program in a second. But first, let's talk about a worst-case scenario. And, of course, this is science fiction. We are talking about a worst-case scenario, not the most logical scenario. But some people have pointed out that because of the oil crisis, the big nations of the earth will be grabbing for as much oil as they can around the world, including resources like metals. Commodity prices are skyrocketing as a consequence of the industrialization of China. And some people predict some kind of collision to take place, in which case, just like two animals that are squaring off, they bare their fangs. And sometimes a miscalculation takes place. So let's say it does go to a conflict in outer space, not anytime soon, but let's say in 20 years. At that point, 20 years from now, when space weapons are much more developed than they are now, what will be the consequences? For example, how much debris will be created in outer space? Can you win such a war? What will a maximum war look like?
Well, when you say it's the worst case scenario, it truly is. And what it would look like, basically, would be that other countries would smash satellites with kinetic kill weapons. We might not smash satellites. We might use other methods of damaging or destroying satellites of other nations. But in any event, you're going to end up with a lot of debris in space, in low Earth orbit space. And if you do that, you're likely to render space useless for any purpose for many hundreds of years, if not thousands of years. if you create a lot of debris in space, and already we have nearly 18,000 pieces bigger than my fist circling the Earth, and those are big enough to destroy any satellite, including the space station. If you create enough debris in low Earth orbit, you make space unusable. That means you can't replace communication satellites and global positioning satellites and weather satellites as they wear out. And the global economic system would collapse. We'd go back to a 1950s style economy. But now we have 6.5 billion people in the world. We can't support 6.5 billion people in the world with a 1950s economy. You're going to have resource wars. You're going to have malnutrition. You're going to have starvation. It'll be a massive, massive calamity for humankind.
So in other words, you're saying that there really are no winners if there's an all-out war in outer space and all hell breaks loose and we have thousands and thousands of pieces of debris ending the space program.
Absolutely. There would be no winners, and the planet would be the huge loser. I tend to be a fairly conservative person. And part of my conservation idea is that we should conserve natural resources, including space. Space is a huge natural resource, and we cannot damage it to the point where we can't use it anymore.
Okay, now let's talk about a positive program. There was the Outer Space Treaty of 1967. Many people think it's out of date. I've seen some editorials by the right wing saying that, of course, we're going to violate it. After 2020, in fact, there could be a traffic jam on the moon. The Chinese will probably beat the United States to the moon. Even NASA officials now acknowledge that fact when we go back to the moon in 2020. And if we have a traffic jam on the moon, it means that people are going to be planting flags on the moon, saying we want this territory, that territory. So it's going to be a mess. So some people say now, not 2020, but now is the time to sign a treaty. What would a treaty look like?
Well, the first thing that has to be done is you have to have a president in office who is willing to say to his diplomatic corps, we're going to talk about a new treaty and talk about it seriously. We haven't had a president. Ronald Reagan didn't do that, and H.W. Bush didn't do it. Bill Clinton didn't do it, even though he's a Democrat, and certainly George Bush II hasn't done it. We need a president who says, let's get serious, let's sit down at the table, and see if we can begin working this out. As for what a treaty would look like, it would prevent any space-related weapons, weapons in space, weapons on Earth that can be launched into space. It would have to be fully verifiable, which would mean inspections in space and inspections on the ground before you launch, and inspections by robotic satellites after a satellite is in orbit. You would have to have an international system capable of tracking all satellites from the time they're launched to the time they die. We're not talking about a huge technological challenge here. We're talking about something that could be done for a fraction of the cost of the war in Iraq.
And what about claims on the moon? Many nations have now said they're going to put people on their moon, their people on the moon. What about what happens when territoriality disputes break out over the moon?
Well, I think that's a possible future scenario, but I don't think it's likely. There isn't much to worry about in anything remotely in the near future. Maybe 50, 100 years from now, we might have to confront that issue more positively, but the current Outer Space Treaty, 1967, takes care of that. There isn't much advantage. There's no advantage at all to having a military base on the moon. And so far as mining the moon for resources, that would have to be, if we ever do that, it would have to be managed by an international body. I think that's a second or third order issue. The main thing is let's negotiate a treaty that would prevent a conflict in space. Because if we don't do that, and if there is a conflict, we're not going to be able to get to the moon or Mars or anywhere else.
Now, some people say that the Outer Space Treaty already does that. What are your thoughts about those people who say that we already have a treaty?
Well, we have a treaty insofar as weapons are concerned. It prohibits any military activities on the moon. As for orbital space, which is between the Earth and the moon, it only prevents weapons of mass destruction, including nuclear weapons. It does not say anything about conventional weapons. new precision weapons. And that's what we're talking about today. We're not talking about nuclear weapons in space. We're talking about so-called precision weapons in space, weapons that could be called down from space and hit a very precise target, or weapons that can be launched into space to damage or destroy another satellite.
What about people who say that such a treaty would infringe on research, legitimate research like laser transmission in outer space, and so you would throw the baby out with the bathwater?
Oh, I think that's a red herring. I think it's time for the nations of the world to regard space as a resource for all humankind. That's what the Outer Space Treaty says. And you can conduct a lot of research, scientific research, by jointly with other nations and under international supervision. I don't think it would end any research possibilities. Whether or not we would commercialize space, that's a matter for discussion, and it would be a very difficult discussion. But I regard it as separate from the military use of space.
What about the use of nuclear propulsion systems in outer space and advanced propulsions in outer space, which could also be used to propel weapons in space?
Well, I think that's a bad idea. I don't think we ought to go down that route, and there are some people who think we do, but there's no immediate threat of that. Again, the immediate threat is our robotic satellites that can destroy the satellites of other nations. We need to take care of these first-order things first.
What about the whole question of nuclear power packs in outer space?
Well, that's a controversial issue, and you well know that working on the Cassini project and all that, and I'm not able to really comment on that very thoroughly because I'm not completely up to date on these little nuclear generators. But again, I am focused on one issue, and that's to keep space free of weapons and to prevent space-related weapons being developed.
And any parting thoughts for those people who may want to pick up a copy of your book, Twilight War, The Folly of U.S. Space Dominance?
Well, my parting thought is simply one I've already stated, that space is a resource for all humankind, and we should treat it properly. And that means we should not have a conflict in space. That means we should not have weapons in space. That means we should not have weapons on Earth that can target weapons for satellites in space.
Well, that concludes our interview with Michael Moore, a weapons analyst, author of the book Twilight War, The Folly of U.S. Space Dominance. Well, in the last few minutes of exploration, I'd like to add some comments of my own. And first of all, for most of you who watched that impact on the moon the other day, perhaps you were disappointed. But on the other hand, some conspiracy theorists say that we were just doing target practice on the moon in preparation for some kind of full-scale space war. Well, maybe in the future. But as of today, the United States military simply does not have any of the capability of fielding a U.S. military program in outer space, especially on the moon, which is about 3 days away as a rocket flies. However, in the future, it's something to think about. In the present, what we have to think about is satellite warfare. And the Chinese have an expression, never pick up a rock, only to drop it on your own feet. Well, this rock could be space weapons, and your feet could be the vulnerability of the United States to a space war. Because, after all, hey, give me a break. Who's the most vulnerable to a space war? Who has the most communication satellites? Who has the most weather satellites? Who has the most satellites devoted to the internet and GPS system? Well, obviously, it's the United States. So if a space war does erupt, who's going to be the first to suffer the consequences? The United States. Well, you may say to yourself, but isn't it good if we have the military advantage so no one can sneak up on us? Well, there's a problem. And that is, if a rogue nation were to simply send up a satellite with an atomic bomb on it, it could literally wipe out a huge chunk of the world's communication satellites with a single blast. And remember, there are nations that have that capability of putting up an atomic bomb in outer space. Even the North Koreans could probably do something of that magnitude. And if that happens, well, there goes your space systems. You see, our satellites are not reinforced. Our satellites are sitting ducks. Even solar flares have been known to wipe out space satellites. And certainly you can do a lot of damage by sending up an atomic bomb in outer space and wiping out a huge number of satellites. You see, there's a wild card in all of this, and this is the electromagnetic pulse. It's not science fiction. It's real. It's based on real physics. Back in the 1960s, the United States, believe it or not, had a secret operational killer satellite program based in Johnson Island in the Pacific, but we're using Thor missiles to hurl nuclear bombs in space. Well, one atomic bomb was detonated in outer space and released a huge electromagnetic pulse, something that had never been seen before. It wiped out communications across the Pacific. Communications from San Francisco to Tokyo were interrupted. Burglar alarms were set off in Hawaii, and the electromagnetic pulse became part of the vocabulary of any military planner. So, in other words, it wouldn't take much. It wouldn't take much for a small nation to set off an atomic bomb in outer space, which would wipe out our space satellites and wipe out communication systems on the planet Earth, which are also not reinforced to handle the electromagnetic pulse. So in other words, all hell could break out. So in other words, who has the most to lose in case of a space war? And that is the United States. Well, I'm afraid that's it for Exploration. Once again, our special guest was Michael Moore, a weapons analyst. The book is called Twilight War, The Folly of U.S. Space Dominance. And this has been Professor Michio Kaku. Join us every week on Exploration as we discuss the world of science and its impact on society. And check out my website. It's www.mkaku.org, mkaku.org. Good day.